Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. They were common in the 1960s. They were occasional in the 1970s and 80s, and they occurred rarely in the 1990s and the 2000s. We're talking about wild celebrations in a NASA mission control room.
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars. Time to see where our curiosity will take us.
The sound of pure joy as scientists and engineers celebrated the successful landing of Curiosity, the largest rover yet to land on the planet Mars. White House science advisor John Holdren said the U.S. space program is back.
If anybody has been harboring doubts about the status of U.S. leadership in space, well, there's a one-ton automobile-sized piece of American ingenuity on the, that is... And it's sitting on the surface of Mars right now, and it should certainly put any such doubts to rest.
We'll discuss whether the U.S. space program is back or if it ever went away, and we'll look at what it will take to take the next step, a human on Mars, and whether all of this is worth the money we are spending on it. Later, we'll hear from a scientist who says we must not only land on Mars, but settle Mars. But first, we welcome OSU astrophysicist Mike Stamatikos, who also works with the NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Mike, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks. Good morning.
We'll get to the science in a moment, but we all heard the cheers. We saw the celebrations at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You know, NASA has had its share of bad news or not so good news in recent years, had its budget cuts. How big of a deal is this landing for NASA?
Well, I think it is a big deal. This is an incredible, incredible achievement. We've been sending Martian lunar rover landers since the mid-70s with the Viking landers, and this will be the seventh landing with Curiosity. But as was previously mentioned, this was one of the largest rover we've sent so far and presented some complications in terms of actually landing the rover. The Martian atmosphere is extremely thin. It's about a hundredth of that of the Earth's atmosphere. So you have to worry about it, but it's not enough to completely slow you down. So one of the incredible things that had happened so far has been the actual landing, which has been dubbed the 7 minutes of terror, basically, and also codenamed EDL, entry, descent, and landing. Basically, there's various complications involved, including suspenseful moments. For example, there's 14-minute radio communication delay between Earth and Mars. So basically, when we get the first telemetry that Curiosity has entered the Martian atmosphere, basically, the 14-minute delay means Curiosity could either be alive or dead on the surface, and we won't know the difference until we get the telemetry back from Mars. It takes 7 minutes to actually go from atmosphere to surface, so basically you're going from 13,000 miles per hour to 0 miles per hour in 7 minutes.
Wow.
It's an incredible dynamic. The entry angle has to be right, otherwise you're going to either skip off or burn up. And the extreme heat coming in, even when it's slowing you down, can reach up to above 1,000 degrees at 1,000 miles per hour as you're skimming in and using the atmospheric interaction to slow you down. Eventually, you open up a chute, and this is only a 100-pound supersonic chute that's actually rated at 65,000 pounds of force. It pulls about 10 Gs, and that will further slow you down to about 200 miles an hour. And this was tested with F-18 Hornet jets at JPL, so there's amazing engineering synergy. You eventually cut the chute, and you start descending on around 8 rocket engines, and you drop down. You don't want to completely go down to the surface with the rockets because then you're going to disturb a lot of dust. So then you, at the last 20 meters or so, you drop down on a sky crane, and then you eventually cut, and the rocket flies away. It's an incredible thing. 6 vehicle configurations, about 80 pyrotechnic devices, about 500,000 lines of code with zero margin of error.
Really, I mean, if you watch the animations that we've seen on television and on the web, it really is, it's incredible. I mean, it looks like science fiction, but it happened, and it happened successfully.
Yes.
How is the actual rover different than the Viking rovers that we all remember? The other rover, I forget the name, but landed on the big airbag and bounced along the surface. How is this one different?
So this is much larger. It has 10 instrument classes, so many more instruments and actually more sensitive instruments. One instrument in particular, which is called the SAM. It's the Sample Analysis at Mars experiment. This is about the size of a microwave. And essentially what it does is it will accept either drilled or scooped samples and heat them and then see the ionized gases, look at the isotopes, and look for organic molecules, processes that are indicative of organic conditions. And this is the objectives of the Curiosity rover are to basically assess the biological potential of Mars in the sense of either past, current, or potential future ability to sustain that. We also want to characterize the geology and geochemistry of Mars, and then a critical role in this is looking at the role of water and also how the atmosphere has evolved and affected the climate.
Why is this important? Why do we need to know this?
Well, this is important. It goes after the big question in terms of how, you know, are we alone in the universe? Is life unique to Earth, or can we find other instances of life in the solar system? Is there other processes that life can evolve, or is there one main sequence that it happens? So that's going back to the big questions that actually define us as humans. Curiosity itself was named by an essay winner, a 12-year-old essay winner, who had a fantastic quote in terms of what curiosity is to mean. It's the everlasting flame that burns in everyone's mind, and that's what captures the legacy of us as humans. So if we want to answer the question in the past, then also take humans there in the 2030s, one important investigation that the Curiosity will provide is a spectrum of surface radiation. So this will protect our astronauts and when we eventually go in the 2030s. So there's going into the past for the big questions, but then also looking to the future.
We're talking about the successful landing of the new Mars rover Curiosity, which landed yesterday. I'm sure you've seen or heard the cheers from all the NASA scientists out in California. Our guest is Michael Stamatikos. He's an astrophysicist with OSU and also the Goddard Center with NASA. Our question for you, the audience, is should we put humans on Mars? Is all of this exploration worth the time and effort and money? 292-8513 is our phone number, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. Also look for us on Facebook and on Twitter. This rover is the size of a Mini Cooper, I've heard. That's the best description I've heard as to the size of it. How fast can it go? How far can it travel? How is it different than previous rovers?
Well, basically, this is it can. It's much larger. It's about the size of a vehicle, as you said. So it can climb over much larger obstacles. About, you know, a 2-foot obstacle, it could climb over. And in terms of speed travel, it can go about a couple hundred meters in a day, roughly 660 feet in a day. So this is, you know, can climb over larger obstacles, but then also travel further. And this is important for the landing site at Gale Crater, where you're looking at very large layering of geological strata. And going back to, you know, 3.5 billion years ago, you're going to want to be able to get in there and get over obstacles and get samples and see what the history remains to be revealed in that geological site.
The drivers are still going pretty slowly, though, 650 feet a day. They're not tooling around the surface.
Right, yeah. You're not going to get a speeding ticket.
The pictures that we've gotten back already, I mean, you see a mountain, a Mars mountain. It looks like any mountain you'd see here on Earth, you know, just sort of jutting up into the horizon. What do you think, make of the pictures you've seen so far?
Oh, they're fantastic. They're still preliminary. I mean, they're going through their checks, diagnostic checks. But this crater, as I said, is about 3.5 billion years old. And at the center of it, there's a mound, about 3 mile high mountain. So you can imagine, you know, how that would look in terms of a scene, and then the incredible geological information that can be extracted from that. So this is a real interesting hotspot geologically that they've chosen at Gale Crater.
Now, previous the Voyager and the previous rovers were expected to last 3 months. They lasted much longer. How long is Curiosity supposed to do its work?
Well, it's going to be one Martian year, so it'll be about 98 weeks. And of course, you know, that's what it's projected. But as you mentioned, the Spirit and Opportunity rovers lasted much longer. Spirit, unfortunately, gave us its last telemetry back in March of 2010, but Opportunity is still sending telemetry. So there's no off switch for these devices because, heaven forbid, you might trip it by accident.
Yeah.
So as long as you have power, basically, you're going to be running. So expectations are high, but basically it's one Martian year.
Because one of the big reason for that is the fuel source. It's plutonium. It's not solar panels.
Right.
So the plutonium will last as long as I call it a battery pack or whatever it's called, will last. How does this affect your research? Research that's taking place at the Goddard Space Center or at Ohio State?
Well, I mean, the effect of the research is a bit indirect. I mean, I work on I'm an astrophysicist by training, so I work on stellar environments. However, I do have an interest in particular with human exploration. I want to be a proponent for that, and I think trying to understand in conjunction with what we're doing on space station and perhaps returning to moon, going to Mars, I think is important of the larger picture. There's a synergy in science that really gets exploited when you look at space exploration. Where you look at biological components or engineering or physics, astrophysics, all those come together when you try to look at those things. If you're analyzing, for example, the surface radiation of Mars, that can inform you of information about particle acceleration and cosmic rays, which is interesting in astroparticle physics and also affects biological effects for astronauts. So there's a synergy there that's I think broad.
What about the inspiration factor? You know, I've seen the pictures of the crowd of hundreds of people, mainly young people, watching this landing live from Times Square. They're like at a drive-in theater. They're sitting on the sidewalk watching this on the big screens there. Will this inspire young people to pursue science, this one success and the subsequent pictures we see from this mission?
I hope so. I mean, I think we got our work cut out for us there. I mean, I think we're a long way away from the million people flooding, Kennedy Space Center to see Apollo 11 launch. But, you need these kinds of successes. We basically decided after the Apollo era to remain in low Earth orbit for 40 years. And now we're deciding to, with the end of the shuttle era, move on into deep space exploration, including moons, the moon, asteroid, and hopefully Mars, which is a very big science driver. So it's a stepwise process, but we have a STEM crisis in the United States, so I hope things like this do boost people to go into STEM fields.
What was your inspiration?
Well, for me, it was a natural inclination to physics because it's just a very the science of nature. But for me, even though I was born after the Apollo heyday, having that Apollo era as part of the fabric of the human spirit, and being an American and looking back at that was incredibly inspiring. For all the incredible engineering and science that goes into these things, there's something about putting boots on the ground, and when Armstrong did that for us. I think that was an incredible moment for all of humanity.
So even though this rover is extremely complicated and will do many things that a human can do, you still believe in putting, as you just put it, boots on the ground on Mars to continue our exploration.
I think so. I think there's a synergy. This is a bit of a debated point in science in terms of do you throw money at automated satellites or robotics, or do you do human exploration? I think you need both, and a perfect example of that is constructing the ISS and also launching and repairing the Hubble Space Telescope. That's a beautiful synergy of having human and robotic space exploration. In the end, all exploration is human, whether it's done by our astronauts or by our robotic surrogates.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael Stamatikos. He's an astrophysicist with Ohio State University and also the Goddard Space Center. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides.
Thank you.
Up next, Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and also Frontline. He'll give us the latest on what Curiosity is sending back from Mars when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
The bipartisan Cybersecurity Act of 2012 failed last week in the Senate despite growing alarm in the national security world about vulnerabilities in the nation's critical infrastructure. I'm Tom Gelton, Emerging Cyber Threats and the Future of Cybersecurity. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, warming up to a high near 90. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 63. Mostly sunny for Wednesday, back up to a high of 90.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. Details at themontgomerysolution.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the successful, extraordinary landing of Curiosity, the largest rover to land on Mars. It happened yesterday. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on the TV or on the web. And if you haven't, you need to check them out because it is incredible what the scientists and technicians were able to do to get this rover onto the surface of Mars. A man who's been covering this is Miles O'Brien. He's the science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, and also he works with Frontline on PBS. Miles, welcome to All Sides on 89.7.
Pleasure to be back, Mike.
You've been covering this. You've talked to the folks who have been involved with this, who have lived and breathed this for years. It's been on its way for 8.5 months. What was it like for you as a, I know you're an objective journalist, but what was it like to see the thing land on yesterday morning?
Well, you're not living if you're not smiling when you see something like that happen. You know, I don't care what the rules of journalism are. That's an extraordinary human accomplishment by any measure. You know, it's interesting. I can't think of many other professions where so much time, effort, money, whatever increment you want to put in, boils down to a complete all-in, all-or-nothing bet, which delivers a payoff or not within 7 minutes' time. It truly is an extraordinary thing what goes into that moment to get a craft like that on the surface of Mars. And it's inspiring to anyone who pays any amount of attention to see what can be accomplished when great minds come together, marshal resources, think of clever solutions which actually look insane, and they work. Mm-hmm. And you can't help but say, gosh, it's kind of cool to be a human. It's also good to be an American because that's where this happens.
What have we seen on day two now? It's been there a day. Is it what kind of pictures are we seeing? What kind of data are we getting back? It's very early, I know, but what are we seeing on day two?
Well, yeah, you know, if you go back to 2004 and the Spirit and Opportunity landings, those missions were designed to be 90 days. Of course, Opportunity is still going, so here we are 8 years later. If you do the math on that, I suspect we're going to get about a 30-year run for Curiosity. But in the case of those missions, because they were sprints, the imagery came down very quickly because they had to assume that there wasn't going to be a tomorrow. In this case, much more deliberate. It's a much more complicated craft. As you know, it's powered by plutonium. It's 10 times the size. All the scientific capability far exceeds what Spirit and Opportunity could deliver. And so they're going to be much more methodical in the early stages on checkout and getting things going. So what we've seen so far have been grainy black and white images from the so-called HazCams, hazard cameras. It's basically the engineering cameras that the rover itself uses to navigate. It's not for any scientific purposes. Today, they're going to raise the mast, the 7-foot-high mast for the Curiosity rover. And on it are the real money cameras. And it's got a telephoto lens, a wide-angle lens, and much higher resolution than we've ever put on Mars before. And so before too long, they'll start capturing images. And before too long, we're going to be getting some imagery of that Mount Sharp, which I think will sort of harken back to Ansel Adams. Imagine if Ansel Adams could have put himself onto Mars. And so, be a little bit patient while they go through the checkout. They're going to take their time. But, boy, I think the payoff's going to be worth the wait.
We're talking about the landing of the rover Curiosity on Mars yesterday with Miles O'Brien, the science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. I mean, just the black and white photo of that mound is incredible. I mean, just the grainy black and white photo. I mean, here, this is a mountain. It looks like a mountain on another world. It's just
black and white and grainy still counts when you consider where it is, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that we see it at all, given that amazing 7-minute entry, descent, and landing scenario that involved the, you know, just kind of, as I described it, it's like Transformer meets Rube Goldberg, and it worked, you know, and so that in and of itself is a huge accomplishment. Now we get, you know, that's the engineering accomplishment. Now the engineering is going to aid the science, and there is a great scientific story to tell there, and Curiosity has all the tools to suss that out.
The mission cost $2.5 billion, and it's been called a miracle landing. You know, 7 minutes of terror. Is a landing that relies on a miracle wise for a $2.5 billion investment? I guess that's the thing that struck me yesterday when I'm listening to the coverage. Is that it was a miracle landing? I mean, that's probably a bit of hyperbole, but I mean, it was big risk, big reward, right?
I think our friends in the media use the M word. I think the engineers at JPL, if you really sit down and start talking to them about this entry, descent, and landing scenario, as I did with Adam Spelzner, who's the lead EDL guy, the guy who kind of gave us the sky crane, if you will, when you start really going through what are the options, you know, of course, if you recall, way back before Pathfinder, early 90s, when we first saw that scenario of the bouncing ball on Mars,
yeah.
Remember that?
Oh,
we
my
all
God.
Laughed. We
yeah.
thought that was crazy. And now we say, well, that's, of course, that's the way you arrive on Mars, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, the bouncing ball material is not strong enough to take, you know, to handle a vehicle of that weight. So that was out. So then you have to say, okay, well, we'll put it on top of a pedestal. And the rockets beneath it, that's more traditional, kind of like the lunar module would be, right?
Yeah.
But then when you start doing the math on that, it becomes extremely top-heavy. And you would have to reduce the payload significantly of the vehicle doing the science. You don't want to do that. And so then the idea came across, well, why don't we put it underneath the rockets? And that's where the sky crane came in, because you can't, with the rockets above the craft landing and getting in close proximity to the surface caused a huge hazard to the vehicle, and that's where the sky crane came in. So when you sort of march down the engineering criteria, you realize this is really the only way to do it. And while, you know, most of us in the mainstream media might say that's a miracle, it's actually a lot of pencil pushing and sleeves rolled up and late nights by engineers trying to figure out the best way to do it. It turns out crazy sometimes is the best.
Oh, I mean, look at Apollo. I mean, they thought those guys were crazy. I mean, the lunar lander wasn't exactly Buck Rogers' drawings. I mean, but it worked. We're speaking with Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, about the landing of the Curiosity, the rover that's on Mars today, taking pictures or starting to think about taking pictures coming back. What does this do to the public perception of NASA? You know, it just retired the space shuttle. Right now, temporarily at least, it has no way on its own to get U.S. astronauts into space. It's taken some criticism for that. It's seen budget cuts in Congress. President Obama doesn't seem quite as keen on NASA as President George W. Bush was. What does this win do for NASA's viability in the next 5 years, 10 years?
Well, you know, I don't know about the premise about the president, so I'm not so sure about that. It was Bush who, of course, set in motion the retirement of the shuttle and, you know, proposed a bold mission to the moon and Mars and didn't fund it. And Obama has done the same thing. They all do the same thing. They talk big on space and they never come up with the money. This is a recurring theme. And absent the Kennedy years, basically, it's always big talk and no money. But putting that aside for a moment, what I think this does is it offers a very important reminder to NASA and to those of us who care about space exploration that you can engage people, and you don't necessarily have to have astronauts along for the ride. The International Space Station, for all of the effort, time, and money involved, hasn't captivated or captured people's attention in any way in its 10-year-plus run compared to the 7-minute ride down to Mars that Mars Curiosity has. People want to go places. They want to see new worlds. They want to wonder and think about life beyond our planet. And in this case, they get to be right there over the shoulder of the scientists as they get the data. It's an extraordinary thing if you really think about it. When in the history of science has the world had the opportunity to share the raw data It comes from a planet with the scientists as they go through it. There's a certain egalitarian nature to this, a crowdsourced component to this that really gets people excited because they're a part of it in a very meaningful way.
There are economic benefits. There was an article in the Plain Dealer today in Cleveland that showed that a couple of Ohio companies, the Timken Company up in Canton, built the bearings that are on the Curiosity. Another company in Ohio helped design and supply materials for the heat shield. So there is some economic benefit from the space exploration.
Well, you know, the $2.5 billion you mentioned, we don't bundle those up into the money bags and ship them off into space. Yeah. Money gets spent here on Earth. But there's a component of this that doesn't end up in the accounting ledgers, in the balance sheet. And if you think about how this inspires our kids, it's hard to quantify it, but I know it really means a lot. You know, when you're in sixth grade and you're interested in science and technology, mathematics, whatever, you don't dream of becoming a sanitary engineer, a waste engineer, right? You want to go be an astronaut or learn how to fly things to another planet. That gets you going. You might end up becoming a waste engineer later in life and realizing that's a better career for you. But this is a tremendous inspirational tool for our youth. And this is one thing that the U.S. still does best, and nobody can touch us in this. And so, for $2.5 billion, it comes out to about $8 per person, $2.5 billion over a 10-year period, I should add. I think that is a really, really amazing investment, not an expenditure, when you think about the payback and what that does for people's desire to be a part of these incredible endeavors, and what it does for U.S. competitiveness in general, because it attracts enthusiasm and great minds to the U.S. as we like it.
Yeah, one of them. I mean, as striking as the pictures, frankly, of the animation of Curiosity landing on Mars was the picture of the hundreds of people at Times Square watching this live. I mean, that's what we saw during the Apollo days, or when the space shuttle first started, was people gathered around to watch the takeoffs and landings, and here were people gathered around televisions, big screens, Times Square, watching this, and it was really quite, you know, surprising to see. I guess we had become kind of jaded, I think, over the past 20 years or so.
Well, you know, some of this is the way NASA told the story of the space shuttle. Was frankly very unfortunate. They sold it as routine access to space that would be no more exciting than watching a 747 take off out of Columbus Airport there. Mm-hmm. That is a complete turnoff to anybody in the general public. Why should I watch that? And so they didn't. In this case, NASA and JPL embraced the risk. As a matter of fact, made it very clear just how dicey this whole proposition was, and in an honest way. And that is what is very, very intriguing to people, to see people take such great risks. You know, a 10-year, $2.5 billion all-in bet is very exciting to see if it pays off. I can't think of any sporting event that's more exciting than what we saw the other night.
Yeah, you talk about ultimate reality TV. Yesterday morning was it. Because we have seen in the past that these haven't gone well, and we've seen the live reaction of scientists' disappointment when a probe or rover, you know, crashes or doesn't perform accurately as it should.
Yeah, I was there in 99 at JPL when we lost the climate orbiter and the polar lander, and that was a real wake-up call, a reminder that this is not easy. I wouldn't even say they make it look easy. I think it looks hard, but they tend to be cool about it in a typical steely-eyed rocket man kind of way. The fact is, it's hard, and it's important that we all know, especially kids know, that it's worth doing hard, complex things. It's worth taking the risk. It's worth, you know, daring to be bold, because this is the payoff.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Paul, you're on the air with Miles O'Brien, science correspondent from the PBS NewsHour, as we discuss the new rover on Mars, Curiosity. Go ahead, Paul.
Great. Thank you, guys. Great talking with you, Miles. Quick comment and then a question. I wish there was an interesting way or a good way to explain to the public and on a continuing basis all the technological advances that have happened because of the space program since the late 1950s. You know, everybody, when you say something like that, people first thing they say is, oh, yes, Tang, or microwave ovens or something. But that's obviously a very teeny, tiny part of everything that's out there, for, you know, with the medical technology, the telemetry, the materials, and how that can invigorate, new inventions, new developments, and the economy as a whole. I just don't think that's pushed enough. But one thing I was my question is because of the Chinese involvement in space, or as they're starting to get involved, and they have a fairly quiet program, but they've done their second orbital mission now, and I guess they're working towards some kind of a space station and apparently of a moon landing at some point. Do you think that will be enough to kind of kick us in the butt and get us, you know, a little more interested again? It seems like we always need some kind of pressure or competition, like we had with the Soviet Union back in the early 60s with the, quote, space race.
Great question. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. First of all, as far as the spinoff issue, I totally agree with you. You know, NASA has a page devoted to this. It's at spinoff.nasa.gov. I'm doing this on the fly, but something along those lines. You can Google it. You can see all the spinoffs that have come out of the space program over the years. Historically, the agency doesn't do a very good job of telling that story for a lot of reasons. But I agree with you that's a story that should be told in a more cohesive way. Maybe we should cook up a business model for that one. But the idea of the Chinese planting a flag on the moon and whether that would, you know, spur some sort of, you know, Apollo redux, I don't know that that is the case. Now, we had an entirely different geopolitical climate in the 60s with the Cold War and you know, nuclear, you know, the mutually assured destruction was the term at that time. And in that context, this was a great way of, you know, fighting a battle without firing off the nuclear weapons. We don't view China in the same way we viewed the Soviet Union in the bad old days. And so, you know, if there were a Chinese flag planted on the moon, you know, I know a lot of people in the space business who hope that would spur up another, you know, kind of Apollo type mission to match that. But I don't see that happening. You know, you got to combine all the what happened with Apollo in the geopolitical context with the fact that it was honoring the goal and wishes of a martyred president. So there was a lot of dominoes were stacked up in a very specific way that I don't see happening again. So, you know, I think it's too bad that we have to respond to negative threats like that. You know, it's too bad we can't do this for other good reasons. But we tend to, you know, what was it Churchill said, you know, we can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they have exhausted every other option.
Yeah.
And we tend to do things with our backs against the wall. But I'm afraid a Chinese moon base may not be enough to make us feel like our backs are against the wall.
How about the other alternative is cooperating with the Chinese, cooperating with other nations to have a joint mission to Mars where we share the cost, share the risk, and make it a global effort to colonize, or at least to put a human on Mars?
Well, somebody say amen to that. You know, listen, if we're going to Mars with human beings, we're not going alone, number one. We're going as a planet, the Europeans, the Russians, and I say bring on the Chinese. I mean, you know, what better, you know, if we perceive China as an enemy, we should hold them close, and this is a good way to do it. To engage with them in space, it's extraordinary. We take for granted now that we're in, you know, this partnership in the space station with the Russians. We have this healthy, long-running partnership with our Cold War bitter enemy. And why we can't see through the issues that are there, the geopolitical issues, in order to partner with Chinese in space, I don't fully understand. I think ultimately, it is to our advantage on several levels, you know, economic and ultimately diplomatic and just in general, because we're going to get further and farther if we partner with the Chinese. But there's a lot of political reasons that's not happening right now.
Thanks very much. Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and also Frontline. We look forward to more of your coverage on Curiosity and other explorations in the months and years to come.
Mike, it was a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. When we come back, we'll talk to a man who wants to not only put a human on Mars, he wants to colonize Mars. And we'll get his reaction to the landing of the Curiosity rover when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the white supremacist movement and the Sikh shootings in Wisconsin. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today for All Sides. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program begins, and it's Tech Tuesday with a discussion of social media and the Olympics, also the top digital cameras, and a discussion of gadgetry. That's Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Jazzoo continues with A Night in Vegas featuring the Columbus Gay Men's Chorus and Small Ensemble Vox Friday, August 10th at the Columbus Zoo. Gates at 6:30, showtime at 8. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine for today, warming up to a high near 90 degrees. Clear skies tonight, comfortable temperatures, a low of 63. Sunshine and back up to a high of 90 on Wednesday, partly cloudy Wednesday night, a low of 67. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the successful landing of the Mars rover Curiosity yesterday. It has begun sending back really their grainy black and white pictures now, but you know, considering they're 350 miles away, it's pretty incredible stuff. And we're talking about the landing of the Mars rover, a success for NASA. And now, what's next? Putting humans on Mars? How about possibly colonizing Mars? Our guest is Robert Subrin. He's the author of the book, The Case for Mars, The Plan to Settle the Red Planet and Why We Must. He is also the founder of the Mars Society, which supports sending humans to Mars. Robert Subrin, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for inviting me.
This has to be a big win for you and your cause.
Yeah, it certainly is. We fought to save this mission in 2007, 2008, when it was experiencing overruns and some people wanted to just pull the plug. And very thankful that then NASA Administrator Mike Griffin had the guts to push on through. And we're seeing those results today. And everyone's celebrating this. But, you know, these things have to be fought for. Right now, even, for instance, as Obama's science advisor, John Holdren, you know, makes very proud statements celebrating this, the administration has cut the Mars exploration budget. It was $600 million in 2008, which is what allowed us to do this. It's $300 million now. Next year, it's going to be $189 million. 3 years from now, it's scheduled to be $80 million. They've canceled the 2016 and 2018 missions that NASA had planned to do together with the Europeans. So, you know, it's really great to be a country that does things like this, and I think people need to stand up and insist that we continue to be a country that does things like this.
So when they're talking about putting a human on Mars in the decade 2030, is that feasible in your mind, given the budget scenarios you just laid out?
Well, it's technically feasible. It's not feasible if you decide not to do it. Their current actions are not consistent with that. In other words, what they're doing is they're making a sizzle when they don't have a stake. You know, and when you talk about sending humans to Mars in 2037 or 2047, it means you don't have to actually spend money on it until, you know, 2025, which means it's somebody else's thing.
Yeah.
You know, really, if these people want to show their bona fides, they need to fund the missions that were on their plate, which is the next robotic missions. Now, yes, from a technical point of view, we can do it. We are much better prepared today to send humans to Mars than they were to send men to the moon in 1961 when Kennedy started the moon program. And if Obama was to get up tomorrow and say, I'm committing this nation to send men to Mars by the year 2020, we could do it.
What would it, I mean, what would it take? I mean, we could spend hours on it, but is it comparable to the Apollo program? They took baby steps. They sent a man into space, then to lower Earth orbit, and then they ventured further, closer and closer to the moon, orbited the moon, finally landed on the moon. Is that what we're seeing with this next step with Curiosity, a larger vehicle using a different method to land on Mars? Is this a step like we saw the steps in the Apollo program?
Well, it is a step, and I would characterize neither the Apollo steps that you outlined nor Curiosity as baby steps. These mm-hmm. are bold leaps.
Yeah, baby steps in the big picture.
Okay. We took three bold leaps, and we made it to the moon nothing, okay? You know, when Kennedy made a speech, we had 15 minutes of human spaceflight experience, okay? We not even orbited the Earth yet. We didn't know if people could eat in space. Now, Curiosity... Okay, we've just landed a payload on Mars that's 10 times as large as the MER rovers that we landed in 2004. So here we are, it's 2012. We've gone up an order of magnitude. You go up another order of magnitude from this one, and you're in the class that can land people on Mars. And the landing system that was developed for this, instead of just bouncing around on the surface with airbags to cushion the blow, which would obviously be inappropriate for a human landing, they set this thing down like a crate of eggs. They had this rocket hovering up there, and they lower a cable, and they just lowered the thing right to the ground. I mean, that would be very appropriate.
Is this what we will see when and if we ever put a human on Mars? Is this the type of landing craft we would see for that mission?
Well, it's one option. It would work. There are other options that people talk about, a more Apollo-like system with the rockets under the vehicle. But those are basically the two options. And either this, you could choose this one, and it has a lot to say for it, actually. It's an extremely gentle system. And, you know, it looks kind of odd. We're not used to seeing things done this way. But, you know, this is the first time for everything.
It does not look as odd as that thing bouncing along the surface of Mars in that big airbag. I mean, that looked odd. This looked kind of – this is the way it should work, you know.
Well, this is like, you know, lowering a car to the ground from a helicopter on a cable.
Yeah.
That's what it basically is. This is a rocket helicopter, and it lowered a car to the ground. This thing's about as big as a Volkswagen on a cable and just set it down. And as soon as they feel the tension loosen up on the cable because the car has touched the ground, they know it's time to cut the cable and fly away.
It took Curiosity 8.5 months to get to Mars. How long would it take a manned spacecraft to get there?
Basically between 6 and 9 months. Mm-hmm. You can get there in 6 months if you want to. In fact, the Mars Odyssey orbiter, which is the one that picked up the signal from Curiosity on Sunday night, it was launched in April of 2001 and reached Mars in October. That was a six-month transit. And we would probably use a six-month transit if we were sending people. It's not that much harder than an eight-month transit. Cutting it to less than six really starts costing you fuel.
Mm-hmm. So it's a fuel issue, not a human physiology issue or anything like that.
Well, obviously you'd prefer the transit to be shorter.
Mm-hmm.
The six-month transit also has the advantage that if you choose to abort the mission, you can fly past Mars, and you'll fly out into the asteroid belt, and then you'll fly back into the inner solar system, and you'll arrive at the Earth exactly 2 years after you left, which means that the Earth will actually be there when you get there. If you arrived 1.9 years or 2.1 years, it wouldn't be there to meet you. So this is what's known as the free return orbit, and that coincides with the six-month transit.
Any estimates on how much it would cost to put a human on Mars?
Well, if we did this in a determined way, which means you set a goal to do it within a decade in the most direct possible way, it could be done for the cost estimates range between $30 and $50 billion for the program. And then once you have all the technology, probably about $2 billion per mission after that. Now, if you make the Mars mission something that you'll do, you know, 50 years from now, in the meantime, people will putter around working on all sorts of favorite technology programs, justifying them on the basis that this will be useful someday when we go to Mars, you can have unlimited cost. It could be done for, you know, say $40 billion, the cost of a medium-sized military procurement, like the vertical takeoff airplane or something.
If you add in the overruns, you can buy two of those airplanes.
Yeah.
should we go it alone? Should we partner with other countries? We talked to Miles O'Brien from PBS about, he says that we should partner with China. That would make sense both, you know, economically and diplomatically and politically.
Well, I think this should be a human endeavor, not a nationalistic endeavor. But I think that if you completely collapse all the programs into a single cooperative program, you risk taking sort of the dynamism out of the system. I'd like to see a sort of a Olympic-style competition, as it were. We're all going to Mars. We're sharing data. We're there to rescue each other if necessary. But, you know, we each bring our own ship. We each send our own probes. And we compete with each other to demonstrate excellence in the pursuit of advancing the human frontier.
We took an email from Arlen. The email writes or reads, he's been looking into the opinion of a scientist about the idea or the problem of colonizing Mars. And he suspects that we have to have human, he calls them Martians, born in a rotating space station for artificial gravity to survive on Mars and to make this trip. Kenneth, what about the zero gravity, being in space for 2 years? Can we physically do it? Can humans physically do it?
Well, you don't need to be in zero gravity for 2 years. First of all, the transit is 6 months, which is the same as a standard rotation in the space station. So people can take zero gravity for 6 months. We do it all the time. Although I would prefer, in order not to decondition the astronauts, that we do, in fact, rotate the ship on the way out to Mars, and this can be done, and this would create artificial gravity and avoid any of the deconditioning effects.
What's the gravity level on Mars?
One-third Earth.
Okay, so it's not as you wouldn't be as light as you are on the Moon. The Moon is, what, one-sixth?
Correct.
So still, that's one-third, 30% of the gravity here.
Yeah. Now, listen, you know, I once asked Buzz Aldrin, who, of course, had been in both zero gravity and lunar gravity and Earth gravity, what was lunar gravity like? Did it seem more like Earth gravity or more like zero G? And he said it was much more like Earth gravity because there was an up, there was a down. You could put a coffee cup on the desk and it would stay there and the liquid would stay in the cup. It wouldn't turn into little spheres floating around the room. And just the physiological feeling, no doubt due to the fact that the body fluids went to the right places instead of, you know, migrating around, made it seem much more like gravity. And the one-third gravity on Mars is very helpful for astronauts because it means that these spacesuits, which otherwise would be very heavy, would not constitute a big burden for them.
Not as big as the burden that the moon lunar landers had. We're speaking with Robert Zubrin. He's the author of The Case for Mars, Why We Should Settle Mars. And we're speaking about the landing yesterday of the rover Curiosity. Successful landing, incredibly successful landing of the rover Curiosity, which will now start sending back what promised to be incredible pictures from the surface of Mars. You know, you talk about the sophistication of Curiosity, all the things it can do. You know, it can take high-resolution pictures. It has a mini lab on it that can test materials. It has a camera that shoots lasers at rocks and a sensor that can measure the chemical composition of that rock. Some people say that's a case why we don't need humans. We have this sophisticated equipment run by humans, designed by humans. Why take the risk of putting a human into that far on that far on that long a trip, and the cost of human spaceflight?
Well, it's Curiosity's great, and one instrument, by the way, that it has that you didn't mention is has a methane sniffer. It can detect methane, and not only that, distinguish between methane produced by bacteria and other microbes and methane that would be produced by geologic processes. Mm-hmm. So it can actually catch the scent of life on Mars. But where is that life? It's probably in the groundwater several hundred meters under the ground. If we want to actually find that life, we're going to need to send humans there to set up drilling rigs to bring up some of that groundwater and look at those samples and analyze them and subject them to biochemical testing and discover what their structure is like. Is it like Earth life or is it something alien? And, you know, these are the kinds of things that humans can do. You know, it's conceivable that Curiosity could find fossils, but Curiosity will be able to travel 300 meters in a day. Now, that's three times as fast as the MER rovers, but 300 meters in a day, a human could walk that in a minute. And, you know, Steve Squires, who is the principal investigator of the MER rovers, you know, Spirit and Opportunity, but is also a field geologist, said that, you know, everything that those rovers have done in 6 years on Mars, he could have done in a couple of hours had he been in the field there. You know, finding fossils on Earth, like here, I live in Colorado, it's dinosaur heaven. All the dinosaurs came here to die and get buried. And Triceratops, Tyrannosaurus, they were found here. You could land 100 of these rovers here in the Rocky Mountains, and you'd never find a dinosaur fossil. It takes real rock hounds scrambling around, following up clues intuitively, digging, breaking rocks, doing delicate work, all kinds of things before you unearth these fossils and figure out what they are and put them together and make them look like dinosaurs instead of, you know, chips of whatever. And so if we're really going to want to know the truth about life on Mars, we're going to have to send people. And, of course, if we want to find out the other thing we want to know about Mars, which is that can it be a new world for humanity, we're clearly going to have to send people.
And that's what you advocate as the next step, not only putting humans on there to research, to look for life, to walk, to explore the planet. You want colonies developed.
Yeah, well, to take it in order, I want to maintain a vibrant program of robotic exploration of Mars. So I'm very much concerned about the fact that the administration has decided to abort our program after Curiosity and one other legacy mission, MAVEN, that's going to be launched next year. So we should not be aborting our robots. If we want to prepare the way for humans, we got to keep sending robots. Then I want to send human explorers. That is within the means of our age. And then start building a base on Mars and eventually learn enough about Mars where so that humans can be self-sufficient there, and then ultimately it will be a place that humans can colonize.
And you've talked about transporting, you know, materials back to Earth that we need.
Yeah, well,
we're getting real Buck Rogers now, but yeah, this is
What I'm really talking about, first of all, is in my Mars mission design, it's called Mars Direct, and it's described at length in a book I wrote called The Case for Mars mm-hmm. that people can get. We make use of Martian resources to aid the first mission. We make fuel and oxygen on Mars to fly back with so we don't have to bring them out from Earth. And Mars is a carbon dioxide atmosphere. It's got water in the soil, and that makes you able to make hydrocarbon fuels and oxygen oxidizer and also use water for human needs and to grow plants and so forth. And these are all things that we can do in early missions on Mars, make use of Martian resources, live off the land. This is what ultimately will make Mars colonizable. Now, if you're talking about an economic product from Mars to transport back to Earth, it's possible that there'll be material things there. Mars has had a complex geological history that has created mineral ores, and who knows what we'll find.
All right,
but I actually think that the main product that will be sent back from Mars, if there was a Mars colony, will be inventions.
Right. We'll have to, Mr. Zubrin, Robert Zubrin, author of The Case for Mars, we'll have to leave it there. Endless possibilities. Thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.